Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the Education Finance Division to order, please. Today's agenda includes additional presentations from House Research and then more introductions from different organizations that will be coming before the committee over the session. I'd like to start, Representative Erickson, if you had the chance to review the minutes.
I have another one in my
Mr. Chair, I wasn't present yesterday, so I shouldn't move approval.
That's thank you for catching that, Representative Erickson. Representative Daniels, I'm working the right side of the committee today.
I so move the minutes.
Thank you, sir. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the Daniels motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, we're glad to be back for another hour today. Ms. Adrians is going to start with an overview of big picture state budget items for you. The materials from yesterday that we're going to refer to include the general ed printout, so you may want to dig that out as well. Again, today, we're happy for questions as we go through the presentation.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Hold on one second.
Yeah, that sounds good. Mr. Chair and members, before Ms. Adrians gets started, we just wanted to put one additional chart up for you about the history of state and local tax revenue. This chart is on the fourth page of your PowerPoint handout. And the purpose of this is just to set a little time trend history for you about how, if you add up the major sources of state and local tax revenue from 1957 forward, you can see how those have changed on the colored lines on this chart. And a couple of places are marked that are somewhat significant in Minnesota's fiscal history. You can see the vertical line in 1971 for the Minnesota Miracle. And one of the things you can see at that point in time is that the predominant source of tax for all state and local government efforts was the property tax. And you can see that had been as high as the upper 50% in the years from 1957 toward 1971. And then you can see that the second line, the purple line from the left, was the other taxes. You can see how reliant the state was on other taxes at that point in time. And then after the miracle, you can see the red line, the increase in the state income tax, and then the green line starting in 1967 with the state sales tax, and see how those lines have changed over time. And the purpose of this chart is just to give you a little historical perspective about how the tax sources have changed for financing all of the state and local government activities in Minnesota. There's a box for the 2003, fiscal year 2003. That's the year that the House, Senate, and Governor Ventura agreed to something called the Big Plan. And several things happened in that. The predominant one on the school side is school district levies were lowered by almost not quite half, by about $1 billion. School district levies were reduced that year and replaced with state aid. There were a number of other shifts in the system at the time as well. But those two markers, 1971 and 2000 and fiscal year 2003, are really some of two of the bigger changes in the overall state government financing scheme in Minnesota.
Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm so sorry. I was so excited to get into the bulk of the presentation that I meant to start with some of the first pages just to orient you as to what we want to talk about today. And I think I was so distracted that Representative Erickson missed out on our whole presentation yesterday. So we'll give her a personal overview. But what we want to talk about today, we were sort of talking about some of the documents yesterday and things that will come up throughout session. And today we're going to back up even a little bit more, and we want to just kind of review the overall state budget and how the K-12 education portion fits into that a little bit more. We'll dive into some enrollment trends, some special education trends, and then if we have time, we might get into some of the operating referendum trends. So we, as we go through the presentation, as Mr. Strom said, please ask us if you have questions and you want to help some help with some of the technical pieces. And we might make reference to some of the documents that we covered yesterday, not to confuse you, but just to show you how the interplay between all of the information that we provide. We're going to focus a little bit more on fiscal year 2020, whereas yesterday we were talking a little bit more about the fiscal years 18 and 19, and now we're going to start to look to the present and future years that the legislature will be making appropriations for. So I think I'll let Mr. Strom do one more slide before we get into the general overview.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, one last thing we want to set as a bit of background for you is how to read the forecast document and how to be thinking about the potential amount of money that this year's legislature has to spend. As members know, the legislature receives a forecast from the executive branch in a November forecast and a February forecast. These summarize the revenue and spending and the state economic trends with the goal of giving you a roadmap of how revenues and spending look. If you focus on the middle column, that's the 2 years you're going to be budgeting for to begin with. You can see that the fund balance coming in is $3.194 billion, that the estimated revenue coming in is $48.326 million, that the spending is a little less than that under the base budget assumptions, assuming no new bills were to pass this year, and that leaves a positive gap between revenue and spending of $872 million. When you put the money in the reserves, you can see that leaves $4 billion before reserves, and then for the statutorily required reserves, you can see that the cash flow and budget reserve are specified right now at $2.4 billion, and another $98 million is in the stadium reserve. So that leaves a bottom line number, forecast budgetary balance of $1.544 billion. But we want to emphasize for you, if you look at the middle line that's bolded, if you go to the next year, we've got question marks at the top and the bottom. Any dollar you spend this year off that forecast budgetary balance line, the $1.544 billion, is going to be one less dollar that carries forward to the beginning fund balance into FY 2022-23. So another way to think about this is there's $1.544 billion on the bottom line this biennium. There'd be another $456 million next biennium. But if you were to do ongoing spending with no change to the estimated revenues and no change to the estimated spending, if you add those two numbers together, that's $2 billion for the 4 years. So the point we're trying to make here is not to worry you or concern you, but if you were to spend all $1.5 billion in this biennium, you wouldn't be able to spend at that same level next biennium absent an adjustment in the revenue or spending that's otherwise on the table in front of you. Your budgeting, as I said, is going to be for the 2021 school year, but as Ms. Adrian said yesterday, we also are concerned with where the revenue is in the TAILS budget, and you can see that the TAILS budget is going to be the tighter of the two according to the November 2018 forecast.
Representative Pryor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and because I do really want to understand this, and internalize what it means and the significance of it. So people are always saying, well, there's one-time spending or one-time money available, and then there's the ongoing budget in the future. Can you speak to that issue a little bit?
Sure.
Mr. Strong.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. The one way to think about it, and there are many ways to think about it, but one way to think about it is for the next 4 years, there's essentially $2 billion of money available. If you were to spend $500 million per year this year, next year, and have that built into the base for the next two, then you'd be at zero with the $2.4 billion fund balance at that. So you could potentially spend up to $500 million in 20, $500 million in 21, and be at a steady state for the next two. But you couldn't spend all $1.5 billion and be at a steady state because there's less in 2023 available. So the talk about one-time spending is, well, if the legislature spent $1 billion this biennium, how much would it have to spend in the next, the answer would essentially be zero. You'd be at that same level. If you spent somewhere less than that and spent one-time money, then you'd be potentially at a sustainable level with this revenue and spending estimate into the future. So if you spent, let's say, $400 million per year, you could spend $420, $421, then you could do some one-time spending this biennium and still be within your tails target, assuming no revenue or spending changes in the out year. So really the way I look at it, very, very simplified, is that somewhere below $1 billion of spending can be your ongoing spending for this biennium if you want that spending to carry on. The more one time you do, the more likely you're going to fit into your 22-23 tails target. But again, that's assuming no revenue and spending changes, assuming that the current economic forecast is the one that stays in place. So that's why we have that question mark at the top and the bottom. Really, the amount of spending that you choose to do this biennium is going to determine what next biennium looks like.
And Mr. Strom, you're assuming all of that $400 million would be spent in the K-12 budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
And
Ms. Adrians.
And members, as Mr. Strom alluded to further complicate things, we'll have another forecast in February. And, you know, the hope is that it doesn't wildly change any of these numbers too much, but there's always the possibility that the numbers will change a bit. So please keep that in mind. Now, Mr. Chair and members, we'd like to talk a little bit about where the money comes from. So this is for fiscal year 2020. The state general fund resources, and it is just under $27 billion. As you can see, the largest sources of revenue for the 2020 general fund are the individual income tax, the general sales tax, and the beginning balance transfer in that Mr. Strom referred to, which is just over $3 billion. You'll go to the next slide. Where the money goes. So for fiscal year 2020, for the state general fund, the spending is just under the amount of revenue that is projected to come in. And as we mentioned yesterday, the majority of the state general fund is dedicated to education spending, and with health and human services being the second largest chunk at 32% of the budget. Yesterday, Representative Juergens asked a question about the sort of the historical trend of how much of the portion of the state budget education is. And I looked back, and since the fiscal year for 1990, it has ranged from 32% in that fiscal year to as high as 48% in fiscal year 2013. But on average, it stays kind of close to that 40% of the total general fund budget range. On the next slide, this is the major components of the school finance system. This is more of an all funds look at the revenue for education finance in the state. And so we can see that general education and special education, they still make up the bulk of it, like we talked about yesterday, a bulk of the revenue for the schools. And one of the things that I think is interesting about this chart is the federal share is just 5.5% of the total. So what this amounts to is just under $800 million for fiscal year 2020. And the source of it is, I believe we talked about this yesterday, it's things like Title I funds, special education funds, nutrition programs like school lunch. Those all come in through that funding source. The pieces of the pie that are labeled facilities, community education, local option, and operational referendum, these are all reflecting that $3 billion of levy revenue that we spoke of yesterday as well.
Ms. Adrians?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
First, perhaps channeling my inner Juergens, do you know how that federal funding has, that portion of the state education funding that is federal has varied across time?
Mr. Chair, I was hoping someone would ask that question. I do not have those numbers in front of me. As I was looking at the others, I looked. I don't know if Mr. Strom has
Mr. Question. Strom?
Mr. Chair, there was one unusual year, fiscal year 10, the federal government passed its stimulus relief bill, and there was that year was exceptional in terms of federal funding and breaks the trend. But the general trend has been from about 6.5% down to 5.5% over the last 25 years or so. So it's been a general slight decrease in that overall amount of federal funding over time.
Thank you, Mr. Strum. And Ms. Adrians, on this pie chart, I don't see English language learning revenue broken out. Is it that small a proportion of our spending?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that would be included, I believe, in the general education portion of the pie.
Okay.
So it is, you're exactly right. It's a pretty small chunk of the overall revenue for the schools.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this could be answered. In terms of special education, the federal support of that part of the budget is what about 16%, 17%, where it's supposed to be, according to the feds, 40%? Am I correct?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, we'll look up that last couple of numbers we have. That federal share continues to fall, and I think it's closer to 10% than 16% now, and we'll check and see where that is. But each year that federal share has been falling since we've got there's a special ed chart I think we've got in this presentation. If not, I'll try and find it while Ms. Adrians is talking, that we can show you that trend over time. But it's been a fairly gradual decrease over time. So,
Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think originally they were supposed to cover 40%. Up to 40%.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Sansby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, do you have any information on the federal portion that's we're receiving in Minnesota compared to other states? Is this on par with other states? Are we above, below?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sansby, we're a little bit below other states. There are many states that are just a little bit ahead of us. Some of the areas outside of the three programs Ms. Adrians mentioned where there is federal support for education include things like impact aid for those areas that have considerably more federal presence, like a military basis, for example. And so there are also states like Alaska that are kind of exceptional that get a relatively larger federal share. We can bring in a state-by-state chart for you that might be helpful, but most states aren't too different from Minnesota. We're at the low end, but not by more than a percentage or two compared to most states.
Representative Sanstead?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Strom, and research. This is good information. I'm curious, so on the special education spending is 10.5%. That's what the state puts in, correct?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'm curious on, do you have any idea how much of the general education budget, that 53%, is spent on special ed?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, we're actually going to talk about special ed a little bit, and we've got the cross-subsidy report in your folders, and there's a nice set of tables in there that I think can get at what we refer to as the adjusted cross-subsidy, which shows the amount of general education revenue that's essentially left to support special education after the state and federal funds are applied.
Perfect. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'll wait until that presentation, then I'll answer my question.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. These are all really good questions, and we hope we can answer them and just continue to ask, and we'll get back to you if we don't have the information in front of us. If we can go to the next slide, this is now we're going to kind of bounce back to the state general fund spending. So this is general education revenue by component. What this chart shows is it reflects that first line of the general education spending that we used yesterday in that one-page high-level overview sheet. So this is kind of just getting at that and breaking it down into the different pieces. Again, kind of a high-level overview. And once again, the basic portion, that biggest chunk of the piece or of this revenue for school districts, it's that $6,312 amount per pupil that all the districts receive. And so the other big ones, again, are compensatory referendum. And also, I wanted to point out that these are the same components that are listed out in that district revenue printout that Mr. Strom walked through yesterday. So we can kind of look back and forth at those as well. Oh, yes. And Mr. Chair and members, as the chair referenced, if you want to look at the EL portion mm-hmm. of this, it's under 1%, so it's 0.7%. So it is a small portion yeah. of the funding that the districts receive.
Thank you. Mr. Strom?
And Mr. Chair, just so members to reiterate, and that you can look on the printout then and see where in each of these categories your districts are compared to other districts in these categories. Next, Mr. Chair, we'd like to talk a little about enrollment and how we count students in Minnesota. I think it's helpful for this committee to be reminded that essentially the funding formulas are primarily driven by a pupil count, and how those pupils are counted is what determines how much funding school districts are going to get in their general fund. Outside of special ed, nearly all the funding formulas are really a pupil-based set of formulas. So we'd like to spend just a little bit of time reminding members how we count pupils in Minnesota, then show some enrollment trends over time. Representative Detmer had asked about enrollment changes, declines in enrollment. We've got a printout in the folder about that for you. And then we'll look at enrollment by region and by size of school district as well. When we count students in Minnesota for funding purposes, we start with the count of resident pupil units. Those are the students who live within each school district's border within Minnesota and attend a public school, either another school district, that school district, or a charter school. The resident count of pupils does not include the number of students in that district who attend a non-public school, nor does it include homeschool students. So when we talk about resident pupils, we're talking about the number that families actually live within the borders of that district that attend public school. It used to be that we funded on resident pupil units, and then when open enrollment came into play and then charter schools, after a few years with both of those programs in play, the state decided instead of making adjustments after the fact, the better option would be to count on the number of children actually served by students. So it used to be that resident pupil units were our measure and then adjustments were made. Now we essentially use the number of pupils served. When we count pupils, we start with that resident pupil count. Then we use a concept in Minnesota called average daily membership. We talked just a bit about this yesterday. Average daily membership means essentially a full-time equivalent count of that pupil during the school year. So if they're split amongst a couple of schools, they count for a portion in each of those districts. Additionally, as I mentioned yesterday, there's no subtraction for a student who's sick for a few days. It's only those that are unenrolled that come off the average daily membership. So average daily membership, and you'll see that acronym again and again on our printouts, really is the number of students that attend the school for a portion of that school year. The adjusted average daily membership is the same thing, except instead of being based on resident pupils, is based on the students actually served by that school district or charter school. So for an example, in Minneapolis, there's roughly about 50,000 pupils who are resident to the district and about a little under 40,000 that are 35,000 or thereabout that are in average daily membership that go to that school district. So adjusted average daily membership is that unweighted count, but it's essentially those who are served by that particular school district or charter school. So we subtract the kids that open and roll out, we subtract the charter school students, and we add in those that open and roll into the district. And then finally, the last thing we do to get our funding pupil units is we weight the students by grade level. And it used to be we had a very complicated set of weights. Luckily now the weighting system is relatively simplified, and we really only have a couple of categories that aren't at one. Secondary students are weighted at 1.2. So if you were a district with 10 students all secondary, you would count as 12 pupil units. If you were a district with elementary kids only in grades 1 to 6, you would count it, and they had the same 10 kids, you would count as 10 pupil units. So again, those secondary kids count 20% more. There are two other small weightings by grade now. There's still an option for parents to choose part-time kindergarten. Most school districts do not offer a half-day program. All but 200 of Minnesota's kindergarten pupils go full-time. But for those that go part-time, the weighting is 0.55. So there, like I said, about 200 statewide that count as part-time students. There are a few districts that offer one section of half-day kindergarten and a few charter schools that offer half-day kindergarten as well. But otherwise, since the full-day kindergarten was put into place about 5 years ago, nearly every student now is in a full-day kindergarten program and counts as 1.0 in the average in the pupil weighting.
Representative Youakim.
Just real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since kindergarten isn't mandatory until school's not mandatory until you're seven, let's say you have a kindergartner that has chosen to be serviced by the public schools, and I speak from a student I just had this fall, and they're only there in the mornings, and then they go off-site to a different program in the afternoon, would then they automatically be counted as the 0.55?
Mr. Strom?
Representative Dabney, Representative Youakim, it a little bit depends. If they're doing it as a half-day kindergarten program, it would count at 0.55. Otherwise, it would count as the number of hours of service that they're actually getting. So if that child were actually going exactly half-time and were in a full-day program but just being pulled out halfway through by the parent, then they'd count at 0.5. Or if they were there 70% of the time, they'd count as 0.7. But again, under the way that kindergarten law passed a few years ago, the parent has the right to have the child there just half-day if the parent so chooses. The school district can't require the parent to have the child there for kindergarten full day. Truancy laws do apply, so if a kindergarten student starts, even though our compulsory instruction starts at 7, if the kindergarten pupil essentially drops out without the parents essentially officially withdrawing the student, then the truancy laws could come into play, even below the age of 7. But as Representative Youakim says, the minimum age right now in our compulsory instruction law is 7.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain to me, and maybe I'm missing it here, the non-public school kids, the private school kids, and the homeschool kids that come into the system for special ed or band, are they counted anywhere?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Hewitt, yes, they are. They're counted under a program called Shared Time, and we can talk a little about Shared Time. I think, trying to remember if we have a slide on that or not. We have a another slide that I sent to Representative Dabney yesterday regarding your question on support for non-public students, and that has the numbers of the pupil counts of the shared time. But there's two types of shared time programs. A non-public student at the school district's discretion may enroll in a core class, and then they count for the hours of service that they get. So, for example, in some smaller communities, particularly the non-public kids may come across the street to the public school for band, or they may come across for PE or something like that. That kind of shared time, again, at the district's discretion, counts those students for the hours that they're enrolled. There's a second kind of shared time which applies to the children that receive special education services. And those students also essentially qualify for the time that the public school is providing special education services to those children. So there are non-public pupil counts in both of those two categories. But essentially until we get to the PSEO program, and again, maybe it makes sense for me to pull this slide up a little later, Representative Dabney, and show you these categories, but it's sort of those three areas where the non-public student receives pupil count support, and those are essentially the PSEO, and then at the lower end, the shared time for special ed and the regular shared time.
Representative Hewitt, and one last follow-up. Is that also included in transportation, or is that another?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, that's a good question. There's a separate line item appropriation for non-public pupil transportation. And maybe, Representative Dabney, would you like me to switch to that chart now?
If you want to wait, that's fine.
Or what do you think is best, Mr. Strom? I'll defer to you.
Representative Hewitt is done with his non-public questions, we'll go on. But he's got one more. I'm guessing it'll be right on that chart.
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Strom, how long has the weighted ratio for secondary students been at 1.2, and how is that established?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandell.
If you want to get to that later.
That's just fine. I've been here a while, but not as long as how long I know that waiting's been around. I believe it was at 1.5 at some point in time. And when I started, it had recently dropped from 1.4 to 1.35. That went down to 1.3 in the late 80s or early 90s. And the department had conducted a couple of studies about how secondary education costs compared to elementary costs. And at that point in time, I don't know if they've done that work recently. At that point of time, it was between 25% and 30% more expensive for school districts to provide services to secondary students than elementary students. The pupil waiting then went a little haywire in the mid-90s when we added additional waiting for the elementary kids by grade level for a class size reduction style of program. Mm-hmm. And when that was all consolidated in, then the thing that brought the ratios back into line was the 1.2. But essentially that higher number was based on the extra costs that the broader curriculum at the secondary requires. And I suspect that if the department did that analysis again now, that they would find that they're probably still somewhere between 120 and 130% for the secondary students in terms of spending.
Representative Sandell?
Mr. Strom, thank you. We can talk about that later. I do have additional interest in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, two other quick things to point out. Minnesota did away with summer school in 1987, and instead districts found a way to use the extended time program through the area learning centers to offer summer programming and extended time programming. That program went through all sorts of changes, but essentially children who meet certain qualifying conditions for additional help, not for enrichment, can qualify for up to 0.2 of extra time for extended time programs. So essentially 20% more for those that need an additional assistance in the summer or throughout the year through extended time programs. And then the top bullet point on the VPK, which is our acronym for Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten and School Readiness Plus, the acronym SRP, while their pupil weighting is one, they're limited to not more than 60% time for the amount that the state pays each year. So for the four-year-old programs, essentially the kids count for up to 510 hours of instruction. Their weighting is technically one, but really they're counting at 60% time because they're essentially going 60% time in many of those programs. So, Mr. Chair, we've taken that pupil count. We started with the resident count of pupils. We adjusted for open enrollment in or out, and we've weighted by grade level. And that gives us the thing that we call adjusted pupil units, and that's our primary measure for funding school programs. So we use that count for nearly all funding purposes. The next chart that Ms. Adrians and I have shows the school enrollment over time from 1960 forward. You can see the top line there is the public school enrollment. You can see how quick that climbed during the baby boom up to 921,000 students enrolled. That fell pretty sharply after that to about 1984. Then starting in the mid-1980s, Minnesota had a fair amount of migration into the state. This was both in migration from neighboring states as well as in migration from other countries. The enrollment started to climb a fair amount, and there were also the children of the baby boomers coming through the system as well. So Minnesota's enrollment grew fairly quickly during the late 80s and the 90s. In 1991, the red line on the chart starts, and that's when charter schools first opened. And you can see if you follow the red line across, the gap between the red line and the dark line is the charter school enrollment. The red line as the top line represents the sum of those two. So you can see enrollment sunk just a little after 2000 and has been growing since. For fiscal year 18, about 871,000 pupils were in our school system, a public system. 814,000 of those were in the district system and 56,000 in the public charter schools. And then there's two lines toward the bottom of the graph. The top of those two at the bottom of the graph in the dots is the non-traditional non-public enrollment. You can see that that peaked a few years prior to the baby boom peak in the public school at about 158,000 students, and then fell not as dramatically, but fell at a fairly constant pace through the late 70s and the early 80s, but has also continued to decline since that point of time. And you can see now that in 2020 or 2019, I guess is the last year on this chart, 65,885 reported traditional non-public students. And the green line on the bottom is the number of homeschool students. Prior to 1985, the state did not have any counts of homeschool, any systematic counts of homeschool students. Homeschooling was certainly allowed prior to that time, but our count starts in the mid-1980s, and you can see that that's grown over time to about 19,000. For many of those early years, the Department of Education believes there was significant undercounting and reporting of homeschool pupils, so it wasn't that it really grew from hardly any to about 15,000 or thereabouts. It was just generally thought to be more compliance each year, and you can see that numbers continued. It's a slow growth, but that numbers continued to grow, and now currently 19,432 homeschool students reported on the last count of homeschool pupils. If we extend this chart out into the future, the Department of Education's estimates do include 22 and 23 that are reported by districts, and the demographer sometimes does work further out than that. There's a gradual increase through 22-23. That increase is expected for several years thereafter and then is expected to slow down. But, of course, any big changes to particular systems like immigration or movement among kids from one state to another could cause those individual numbers to change. So the department used to do an estimate that they called the way out projection. but of course the 10-year out estimate that the department did was not really something that they preferred to see on a printout. But the general sense is that number is going to continue to decline continue to climb a bit. And if we look at indicators like kindergarten enrollment hasn't fallen much over the last several years. So I think the expectation is that there's at least six or seven more years before enrollment trends would start the other direction in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members, populations, if we look at demographic information, populations within the school districts have changed over time. If we look at the last 15 years for four categories, the top line shows the percent free and reduced lunch eligible students, and you can see that that climbed at about 1% per year from 2003 forward all the way up to about 2011. Interestingly, after the during the Great Recession, you can see the line increased pretty sharply for that year, but then not long thereafter that flattened off and has been declining now. So we just got the fiscal year 18 or the 2018 fall counts recently. I haven't finished processing those all yet, but it's down a little more, I think 37.3% or so. So that number of free and reduced lunch students, the percent has stabilized in the last couple of years. The second line shows the students of color in Minnesota schools. You can see that's growing from 18.9% in 2003 to 32.5%. The third line shows the increase in special education enrollment. You can see this increase isn't real dramatic. It's from 13% to about 15.4%. But most of the costs that are increasing rapidly in the special ed area are due to the conditions of the students being served, and so it's really a different population that's driving the costs, not an increase in special education enrollment. And then finally, that bottom line is the number of English learners served in the state of Minnesota. You can see from 2003 to 2017, that's increased by about 2 percentage points. That's a nice steady line on this chart, but as committee members know, that varies dramatically by community, both in the metro and in greater Minnesota. Some communities have had very, very rapid growth. Others relatively little growth in that category. So that's very uneven amongst school districts, but the overall growth has been about a 25% increase from 6 to 8% over the last 15 years.
Mr. Strom, Representative Sandstead has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, on the free and reduced lunch, even though that is fairly stable and maybe even starting to decline. Do you have any information from across the state district-wise, like if there are pockets where it's increasing or decreasing?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandsteed, yes, we do have good information by district, and we'd be happy to put that together for you. One area where there's been some real concern is that some populations may be more reluctant to be counted now than before, and we suspect we're seeing a little bit of that in the 2018 data. Again, we haven't had a chance to look at that as carefully as I'd like yet, but we've got district by district history there, and I'd be glad to send you. We've got a nice little lookup table that you can just plug in the district number and see the change in your district compared to four or five others. So I'll send that spreadsheet off to the committee, and members can plug in those numbers. But I'll print you a couple pages of that as well, so you can see that growth has been uneven depending on the district. Some districts, like the chair's district, have actually had a decrease in the number of free and reduced lunch eligible over the last several years. Other districts, Columbia Heights, for example, and Richfield, have had big increases in the number of free and reduced lunch eligible over the last 10 years.
Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you. Just one more question. I appreciate that. If you look at Greater Minnesota versus other areas, do you see any trends there as far as either increases or decreases?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandsteed, we'll take a closer look at the distribution in Greater Minnesota. In the metro area, the real big change has been the number of the inner ring suburbs have seen that rate go up dramatically. The old analysis that's still true, but a little less pronounced. Minneapolis and St. Paul, as a region for those two, were quite high. The rest of the seven county metro area was quite low, and Greater Minnesota was roughly at the state average as one unit. But why don't we break that up for you by size of district or something like that for Greater Minnesota, and we can see what the trends look like there.
Thank you.
Mr. Strom, your reference to some populations being hesitant to identify, that goes back to the president's threats on immigration status?
Mr. Chair, we're not sure. That certainly would be one. I think one thing that some of the advocates have suggested. We've had a number of folks contact us and say, "Gee, what's happened with the free and reduced count at this school? Why has it changed?" And we don't know the answer to that, but we certainly know what some of the advocates have said about that.
And Mr. Strom, I ask some variation on this question every year, and then I forget your answer, and then I ask it again the next year. If we were to break out free from reduced price lunch eligible, how would that line look? Is there any do they run parallel to each other if we were to chart eligibility for those two different levels of support?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, no, that's a very good question. They don't run parallel to each other. There are a number of districts, particularly some of the suburban districts, where the number of reduced lunch students, the proportion is much higher as a ratio of reduced to free. I'm going to get the numbers a little wrong in my head here. We'll give you a full breakdown of the demographic information in some ways that might be useful, but I think it's about 200 and I think about 210,000 free lunch statewide and about 80,000 reduced lunch. They're set at 130 and 185% of the federal poverty line by the federal government, or where those breaks are set. But it's about 3-1 statewide, but it's very different depending on the type of district. Some districts and charter schools have very few reduced price students and almost all free students. Other districts may have a much closer to 60-40 style of match of free to reduced. But why don't we put some charts together on that? I think that'd be interesting for the committee to see.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Juergens, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, just a suggestion or a recommendation or a request that perhaps someday we could take a deeper dive into the free and reduced lunch program. I know that Mr. Strom is doing an excellent job of answering questions here, but every answer we hear brings up more questions, and so perhaps maybe at some later date we could do that.
We can look into that, certainly. Thank you for the request. Mr. Strom, you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, members, a couple quick things to to finish up the enrollment section. First of those is enrollment by region. Up until 2001, perhaps not surprisingly, more than half of Minnesota's public school children lived in the 80 counties of greater Minnesota. Since that time, the 7-county metro area has had a slightly more than 50% number of the total students enrolled in the state. That number's grown at a slow rate over the last 15 years, but now we're up to about 55%. Of the students in the 7-county metro area. One little note about that: when we measure school districts by where they're located for things like Metro Greater Minnesota analysis, we use the county where the home office is located. And so for some school districts, that may be less reflective of the true nature of how the district views itself. For example, the St. Francis School District is considered a metro district because its office is in the very southern part of that district in Anoka County, whereas the Elk River District is considered a greater Minnesota district because its office is in Sherburne County. So those issues aside, though, the numbers have continued to grow slightly more toward the metro area. The southeast region where the Rochester is, and the east central region from St. Cloud across the northern end of the Twin Cities to the Wisconsin border are the other two areas that are about at 10% of the enrollment each. And then you can see the relative percentage of enrollment in each of the other economic development regions of the state. And Mr. Chair, one last thing, and then we're, I think, done with, well, one last thing on the statewide, and then we'll look at the declining enrollment chart. The percent of students enrolled by school district size is one way to think about how different Minnesota school districts are from each other. This analysis just looks at the 330 school districts. The charter schools also face a similar kind of enrollment pattern, but if you took the 330 school districts and divide them into five equal chunks, or quintiles as we call them, you can see that the first 66 school districts, the smallest 66, have 17,000 pupils in total in them, about 2% of the total. The next quintile, the second quintile, those 66 districts have 37,000 students in them. And the third quintile, again, under about 8% of the total enrollment in the state, is in that middle quintile and 62,000 students there. So you can see that 60% of the students are in very, very small school districts. As you look to the right, then you can see that of the largest 66 school districts, 560,000 out of the 870,000 students are in those 66 largest districts. So it means Minnesota's got a lot of very different school districts, very different enrollment issues, very different staffing issues that come about because of those relationships. So it's something to keep in mind when folks look through our school finance formulas and look at all the different twists and turns they're in. Part of that is because we have 330 school districts in the state, and they're often very unique in terms of their size and how they look in the area that they serve.
One moment, please, Mr. Strom. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strom, would you say that based on what you just mentioned about the difference of our school districts, does that have something to do with the equity issue that we have with funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I think so. There are some small school districts that are 30 miles from the next nearest district in terms of equity on a funding level for them to be able to provide the same level of instruction. They may need significantly more money to just sort of hold a base level of funding there. Some of the medium-sized districts particularly, I think, feel the equity squeeze the most and see that those at both ends, those that are very large and those that are very small, often have special parts of the formula that affect them. Part of that gets to an issue of efficiency. Perhaps running a 3,000 or 4,000 school district pupil size school district might be the most efficient. So there's a lot of things that go into that, but it definitely plays into that equity argument. When you looked at that revenue printout from yesterday, you could see school districts were all over the board in terms of that total revenue, and a lot of that has to do with those special characteristics.
Thank you. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, the last thing we were going to do, and of course I'm looking for the The last thing Representative Detmer had asked about a week ago about student enrollment over time, and we don't want to spend much time on this, but there is in your packet a chart that shows both the 5 and the 20-year change in enrollment. You can see that the enrollment at the top, you can see the state total, and then we've broken it down into the different categories of school districts. You can see that statewide the overall enrollment on the 20-year change is up 4.9%, the 5-year change is up 3.9%, and then you can see by region how those changes are different. And then you can look at your individual school districts, and you can see the enrollment in 2000 and then the enrollment from 2015 forward to 2019 and see how your district's 5 and 20-year changes have been. And you can see that for a large number of districts, that change from that 20-year change is significant. As you look at the 5-year change, there's really a lot less variation than one might expect there in the 5-year change of school district enrollment. As you look up and down the list there are mainly single-digit changes one way or the other. So it really suggests that most districts are facing a fairly calm enrollment picture over the last 5 years. There are obvious exceptions here and there, and of course the charter school enrollment can differ pretty dramatically. But for the school districts, most of them are single-digit changes over the last 5 years.
Mr. Chair and members, while Mr. Strom is setting it up, I'll just kick us off into the next area. We are going to look at some special education funding. There are several experts at the department who know a lot more about this. Well, then I'll speak for myself than I do. But what we'd like to do is just talk a little bit about the state special education spending over time. We'll get into the cross-subsidy and look at some historical trends there, and then variation that occurs in the cross-subsidy by type of district. So the first chart, this is looking at the education funding trends. So the state special education aid per student from 2003 to 2019. And this is showing that when we are not adjusting for inflation, the change from 2003 to current year, it went from about $1,051 per student to $1,708 per student. That's adjusted for inflation. So that's using the consumer price index to look at it. And so it's a little bit, when we adjust for inflation, it's not quite so much of a change over time. When we're not adjusting for inflation, the change is, it looks like, from $762 per student to $1,708 per student. And then on the next chart, this is looking at the special education cross-subsidy per ADM. And this is using, it's a little bit older data, but I think the trends are still, they'll still hold pretty true because we're going back to 2003. So again, when we are not adjusting for inflation, the cross subsidy in 2003 was $453 per student, and looking out toward fiscal year 2021, it goes up to $958 per student. Again, if you adjust for inflation, that the range is not quite so much. It's more like from $659 per student to the $958 in 2021. And then this is looking at that same special education cross subsidy number for just 1 year in time, and looking at it by district type. So if we are looking at some of the biggest districts, so Minneapolis and St. Paul in fiscal year 2017, the cross subsidy, special education cross subsidy, is over $1,200 per student. And then as you move out to the smaller districts, so the inner ring metro area suburbs, it's $905 per student. The outer rings for the metro area, $798 per student. And then you can see it continues to move down. the statewide charters is an interesting one to look at. That's $95 per student. And then the districts, the difference between the districts and the charters, the $801 is a pretty steep difference. And I don't know that we can get into how the special education funding works more at another time. It is different for the charters. The amount that they can bill back to the original district, and so, but we so, and we think that's really relevant information. But for now, I think we're just going to move on.
Okay, we can look into it more on days that we have bills related to special education.
And Mr. Chair, just one last thing: we did put the most recent cross subsidy report in your folder, and there's a few charts and graphs in there. We just want to Representative Detmer's question here. We can show you the chart. This is on page. Page 10 of that document. This is answering a slightly different question than what share of the federal government putting in of the 40%. But what this chart shows the state spending on special education, the federal spending, and the top line being the total amount that's there. And so you can see on the red line there, which is not really the same as the what's the 40% and how much of that 40% is the federal government paying, but you can see the federal contribution over time as a percent of special ed funding, and you can see that one-time big jump in 2010 due to the stimulus money, but otherwise you can see a pretty steady state for the last decade or so from 2007 forward on that federal spending for special education line. And again, this number is not constructed in the same way as that 40% number would be constructed, but shows the trend of the federal funds for special education. And I'd encourage members to take the cross-subsidy report with them, and if the chair would like, Ms. Adrians and I would be glad, or the department would be glad, to give a more full presentation on special education funding. The Senate committee under Senator Pratt had a series of hearings on special education this summer, and the department prepared two very nice PowerPoints with all sorts of charts and graphs related to special ed funding over time that would be a good presentation for this committee to see at some point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, we've chewed up a little more time than we were hoping today. We wanted to end by talking about the operating referendum. So in your folder is another district printout for you. That's a good size to see. So this is on legal size paper turned sideways for you, is a printout of the operating referendum. And we don't want to go through all aspects of this, but we wanted to give you a little taste of equalization, and we wanted to talk just a little about the operating referendum. The operating referendum is the amount that the taxpayers approve at the elections. If you're looking at this printout, the top three lines are some summary lines, and then it's a school district number order printout, district by district. The first column on the printout shows the referendum market value. That's the tax base. Remember from yesterday when we talked about tax base, referendum market value is the tax base that the operating referendums spread upon. And to get the tax base per pupil, we divide that by the resident pupil count, the referendum pupil units, and the tax base per resident pupil is that third column. And the higher that number is, essentially the more property wealth per pupil on this tax base that school districts have. So you can see the relative rank there as you look up and down the list. Aiken is the 46th property wealthiest per pupil on referendum market value per pupil. Its neighbor Hill City, 305th, way toward the bottom. And so as you look up and down that list, you can see where the relative property value of your district is. Minneapolis at $837,000 is toward the high end. It's the 21st highest. If you look through some of the northwest parts of the state, because referendum market value excludes ag land and seasonal rec property, some of the most poor property wealthy districts for purposes of the operating referendum are those with lots of ag land and lots of seasonal rec property. So you can look up and down the list there and see where that tax base per pupil is. And then the operating referendum is equalized in three tiers. And equalization is a term we use in school finance to mean that the state aid flows in around the local levy depending on the property tax wealth of the district. And this program, because it's got these three tiers, is a series of more calculations than one might like to work through a simple example. But basically, the first $300 that voters approve are in that first tier, and the equalizing factor is $880,000. So if you look at the percentage for your district, that's the percent of that first $300 that's paid for by the local levy, and the difference is the percent that's paid for by state aid. So Hill City, very low, district number two on the list, very low in property tax base. On the first $300 that their voters were to approve, the locals would pay 28% of that, and the state would fill in with 72% state aid in that first tier on the first $300. On the other hand, if you were to look at Minneapolis, which is a relatively property wealthy school district, the local levy on that first $300 per pupil is 95% of the total, so Minneapolis only gets about 5% state aid for that first tier of referendum authority. As I said before, the districts that are getting a lot of state aid in this tier are those districts that have low property value, and those tend to be the greater Minnesota districts where the ag land or the seasonal rec has been excluded and makes them low value. The second tier is equalized at a lower level. The second tier is equalized at $510,000 per pupil unit. And you can see there are a lot of districts now in this tier for the next money from the 300 to the, oops, I've got the tier number there, I apologize for that. From $300 to $760 per pupil is equalized at this level, and there are a lot of districts with 100% levy. So now if you're at 100% levy in this category, you're getting zero aid in this tier. And then the last tier is very low. Only the most property poor school districts are going to get a little help with this tier for everything over $760 per pupil of referendum authority. You can see all the 100% levies on the list there. Districts below 100% will get a little bit of state aid in that category, but again, because that equalizing factor is set so low, there aren't many districts that are going to be receiving third tier equalization aid. So those tiers then come into play. So in the next set of columns then show how the referendum revenue looks. If you look, you can see that that's determined on adjusted pupil units. When a district asks their voters to approve a referendum, they ask the voters to approve an amount per pupil unit, and that's the pupil count that's used in that column. The total referendum revenue is next. You can see for fiscal year 20, we're expecting that to be $942 million statewide, with more than half of that in the metro area, about $688 million of referendum revenue in the metro area and $248 in greater Minnesota. And as Representative Detmer asked about equity issues, this is one that sometimes is of concern. When we look at the metro, non-metro average there, you can see the average metro district has $1,446 per pupil of referendum authority, and the average non-metro district has $600 of voter-approved referendum authority. And you can look up and down the list there and see the amount per pupil that districts have approved. And then that's followed by the rank. And then what happens with that approved referendum authority is it goes through those three tiers, and we divide it into an aid and levy. And you can see in the total aid and levy, about $800 million of levy and about $133 million of aid. So the program's still mainly levy. And you can see those amounts per pupil. And then the very last column says, well, what if you had a $200,000 piece of property on referendum market value with this levy? What are your taxpayers paying in your district on that type of properties to support that referendum? And you can see there in a district like Minneapolis, which is a high referendum revenue, high tax-based district, they're still paying about $340 per pupil just for the referendum on a $200,000 house because they have a relatively large referendum. You can look up and down the list there on the first page and see some districts if you sneak down to Comfrey, which is right below Mankato District 81, you can see their voters are paying $500. If they had a $200,000 property, they'd be paying $500 of property tax per year just to support the referendum levy of $1,400 in that district. So it gives you some impact, sense of how those amounts vary. The idea of equalization is to try and put some tax base fairness into the program so that local tax base alone isn't the only factor. But with the tiers set where they are, you can see it's relatively fair on the first tier from a property tax basis because the state aid's bringing everyone up to that $880,000 level. The second tier, many districts are above that level. That's right about the state average amount of tax base per pupil. And the third tier, very much below the state average and just not much equalization for the amounts over. And again, I apologize for the header error, the amount over the $760 per pupil. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very quick summary of the referendum revenue program.
All right, Mr. Strom, thank you. Members, we've got two members with hopefully brief questions, and then we want to move on to the presentations from the education organizations and keep us on track. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Strom. How do you get different numbers regarding the referendum pupil units versus the adjusted pupil units?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I wish I could have hidden that column. Unfortunately, the one place we use the referendum or the resident pupil count, that's the resident pupil count. We use that to determine the ratio of market value per pupil. So that's the number of kids that actually reside in that district regardless of where they attend public school. So in Minneapolis, that's a bigger number. In some districts, that might be a smaller number. But that's an artifact of essentially our referendum always having been based on the resident pupil count up until a number of years ago, and changing that denominator would have had winners and losers throughout the state. So that's the one formula, I think, where resident pupil units is still used.
Representative Detmer? You're good? Thank you. Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Mr. Strom, could you explain rank again?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I apologize. The rank shows up in a few places there. The rank on the tax base per pupil, the higher that number, the lower the rank. So if you're ranked number one, you've got the highest tax base in the state. Same when you go to the referendum revenue per pupil. The rank there is you have the highest amount of referendum revenue per pupil in the state. So those two rank columns, the highest number would be ranked one, and the lowest number would be ranked 330 or thereabouts.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom, Representative Murphy, only refers to the column before.
Yes, just to the column, just to its left in both of those cases.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Thank you, Ms. Adrians. To the members of the Education Committee community, we've allotted 2 minutes each, as you know, because of time, extra credit for those that come in under 2 minutes. We'll do it as we did yesterday, call down the initial person and then the on-deck individual. If they would please also sit at the table, we can tighten up transition times. So Ms. Kelleher has already taken her position. Batting next is the Minnesota Child Care Association, and after that, Intermediate School District 287. Ms. Kelleher, welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Proceed.
Good morning, members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I work for the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I want to start off by thanking you for being on this committee. It is a difficult task in front of you with folks, the education really hemorrhaging and having problems bringing them to your door to fix them. So we appreciate your service to the state and the students of Minnesota. I gave you, and I won't go through it because I'm looking to get a gold star from the chairman. MSBA does a lot more than just lobbying, and many folks, that's rather unique. We're a statewide organization that represents locally elected school board members, and next year we're going to be 100 years old. So hopefully this gives you an idea about who we are, what we are, and how we provide it. Then there's a great little primary color document that looks like this. And you'll see on one side it's got like special ed on it and everything else. We want to turn to the side that's actually got money on it. And these really come from our members, clearly. We were polling them through the fall, trying to get feedback on exactly where they were. And, of course, general education revenue is desperately needed. We can put it in many different pots, as you know it, whether it be lunch, whether it be transportation, most flexible for our members. Special education, oh, and we're looking at a 3 and 3. The total number on that is $588 million. We're looking at special education money, and that's a cross subsidy of $300 million. Mr. Chairman, we need help with mental health, and we would like to see commitment to that going forward. And last but not least, we'd really like the bonding committee to do another round of safety grants. Sure. School districts around the state applied to four safety grants, and the $25 million allotted last year helped some. But unfortunately, these documents that districts did to ask the department are public documents. So we feel, a little nervous that we've listed where we need security help here in our school districts, and now there's no funding to go with it. So if there was an intruder, there was someone to sort of slip under the radar, it would really be difficult for our folks to deal with it. So we'd really like you to consider urging the bonding committee to help. Last but not least, we're so fortunate because not only do we have Chair Davney, who has extensive tax experience, we have Representative Marquardt. And that kind of experience and intuition into education doesn't happen very often. So I'm looking forward to this session, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Ms. Sanford, Ms. Superintendent Lewandowski, you're on deck. Ms. Sanford, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford. I'm a board member of the Minnesota Child Care Association, where we are focused on both high-quality early child development in the birth to 5 years and also being a support for parents as they work or pursue their education. I personally started my career as an elementary school teacher in an urban high-poverty school. The school conditions were horrific. The community conditions were horrific. And I've dedicated my career to the birth to 5 years to try and do my small part to attack those issues as early as possible. So I'm here to voice our strong support for House File 1. And the piece of House File 1 with particular that this committee has purview over is the early learning scholarships. Scholarships start early. Recent language changes allow them to be used for birth to 5. If the birth to 3 years are for certain high-risk populations currently. They're open to all settings rated by Parent Aware, whether those are public schools, child care centers, family child care, Head Start, et cetera. They give parents the greatest amount of choice, and it's tied to quality. They're flexible. They help parents access up to full-day, full-year programming if desired. So we very much need and want more investment in scholarships. We would love them fully opened to birth to five, not just to high-risk infants and toddlers, but to all income-eligible families in that group, and to raise the annual caps on those because they are not currently high enough to allow families to access full-day, full-year if that's what they need. So our preference going forward would be to put all new. We're not advocating to move any education funding currently going to school districts or other pots, but we would love all new education funding aimed at birth to five to go through early learning scholarships for the reasons mentioned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. On deck is Educators for Excellence, and after that, Intermediate School District 709. Superintendent, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Lewandowski, and I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287, and I represent the four intermediate districts in Minnesota. As an intermediate district, my school serves nearly 1,000 of the highest need students in Hennepin County, and nearly all of these students have severe and persistent mental health disorders, are identified as having multiple medical diagnoses, and numerous behavioral disorders. Most have also experienced complex developmental and racial trauma, yet often they are in the classrooms of setting for special education programs in our intermediate district without access to mental health treatment. School districts like mine indeed are the front line of children's mental health, and I testify here today that public schools cannot sustain this effort. We were never designed to provide the equivalent of residential treatment services. Lack of clear policy and sustained funding have put my staff at great risk, and I can no longer ensure their safety. The schools in my district have students with acute mental health crises every single day. Let me tell you about a recent situation in which a girl under 10 arrived at school the day after she had been sexually assaulted by an adult male she had met over social media. She had come to school with broken shards of glass in her pocket intending to harm herself. She has bolted into the street and thrown herself into traffic, and she has made both homicidal and suicidal threats. This is what the front line looks like in my district. It's also important that you know the grave racial disparities that we see in our care and treatment programs. These are programs including corrections and mental health treatments for which we send in educational providers. Our data shows that if you are black, you're six times more likely to be directed toward corrections rather than a mental health program. Our current innovative mental health funding that you provided for 2 years seeks to change that trajectory. We serve K-1 and 2 kids with an intensive therapeutic program now provided by Wilder. This program currently serves all little boys of color. It's our hope that we can change the pipeline to prison by providing such extensive mental health programs in tandem with the school services where they are. The time has come for full funding of school-linked mental health grants, and the intermediates are pleased to be working with NAMI on a bill that will be introduced to address intermediate school district mental health needs. I implore you to consider this bill as a top funding priority this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. So Educators for Excellence is next, followed by Intermediate School District 709, and then the St. Paul Schools. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My name is Shannon Mitchell, and I'm the Interim Executive Director for Educators for Excellence. We are a teacher-led nonprofit that works to get teachers more involved in policy here at the Capitol and at their districts. We have 2,000 members across the metro area, and our members go through a process of voting on which policy issues are top of mind to them and then creating policy recommendations. Year after year, racial disparities in discipline and promoting alternatives to push out is the top issue for our members. Our members see this as a multifaceted problem that needs multiple solutions. And so we are a part of a coalition that is pushing for comprehensive legislation that would do a number of things. It would improve data collection and reporting so we can better understand this problem. It would increase parental notification rights. It would clarify the process and best practices around when we are pushing students out, what needs to happen before, during, and after those suspensions, and it would provide more supports and trainings for teachers to actually implement some of these really great alternatives that we know are more effective than simply pushing students out. Our teachers want to see things like restorative justice become more than a buzzword. We are a part of the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition working on that. That's our top priority. Our other two priorities, our teachers are very interested in equitable school funding. The biggest part of that to them is increasing the funding for special education. We know we're not alone in that. There's a lot of groups calling for that in any way that we can advocate and support those efforts. We're looking to do that. And then lastly, teacher diversity and getting more teachers of color in our classroom is the other top priority, and we're really a proud member of the Teacher of Color and American Indian Coalition and would advocate for their work in those bills. So thank you.
Thank you. Superintendent, welcome to the committee. St. Paul Schools is on deck, and Pacer after them. Please state your name for the record and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Gronseth, Superintendent of Duluth Public Schools. I almost said intermediate. It's Independent School District 709. Like other school districts throughout the state, Duluth Public Schools has struggled financially since the conversion to the new state special ed funding formula in 2016. For the last 3 years, Duluth has been over the cap, which means qualifying special education expenses have gone unreimbursed, creating a budget deficit, or, as you also know, cross-subsidy. Duluth's cross-subsidy is $1,096 per pupil. That makes us the 20th in the state for cross-subsidy. Compounding our budget gap is the need to serve more students requiring special education programming, which causes even more unreimbursable expenses. Our problem wasn't that we spent too much. In the first year of the new funding formula, a large tuition billing increase was applied against our eligible base funding, in effect lowering our minimum reimbursement by over $1 million in just 2016. We have been behind ever since. Now in 2019, we are in effect over $4 million behind in special education revenue reimbursement because of that unforeseen tuition billing adjustment. This is our story. This is Duluth's unique story. As one of many school districts you'll hear from during this legislative session regarding special education funding changes, we understand that the path to solutions is complex. One positive first step the legislature can take is to fund a cross-subsidy aid calculation to help districts forced to use more than their fair share of general education revenue to meet special education needs. ADSIS, a program instrumental in supporting students before they become special education, needs to be outside of that cap. We personally lose that funding because we're over the cap. Thank you for the opportunity to share our needs. I'm sure that I will be meeting with several of you during the session, and thank you again for your work on education.
Thank you, Superintendent. On deck is PACER Center, followed by the Education Partnerships Coalition. Ms. Doherty, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert Doherty from the St. Paul Public Schools. I just want to welcome you to our district and where you are. We have 39, just a brief introduction for those of you that are new. We have 39,000 students, which includes the largest pre-K program in the state. Nearly 80% of our students are students of color, and we're probably the most diverse district in the country. Nearly 70% are eligible for free and reduced lunch, and we've had the same issue as Minneapolis with our families not applying for the services. 34% are EL, and they speak over 100 different languages and dialects. And 50% are special education. In addition, we have almost 1,000 students that are eligible for 504s or have some other health-related service. We have 56 programs, including many Level 3 programs for EBD and autistic kids, as well as Level 4 programs like the intermediate districts do. Last year, we had over 1,900 students that were highly mobile or homeless, and that didn't include the students that were at Safe Zone, shelters that we serve, or at any of our Birth to Five programs. And this year, we have over 1,300 kids. So as the any of you who are on the pre-K committee, poverty does matter when you're trying to address educational outcomes, and I think all the research shows that you have to have great teachers, well-trained great teachers and leaders. And so how do you do that, which is stabilize and fund the gen ed program, address the $50 million special ed hole or pre-K hole that we have, fund the special ed and EL cross subsidy, tie extended time to the formula, and fund teacher of color programs. And please, oh, please, oh, please do not give us any new mandates.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. We get Ms. Clark, followed by Ms. Clark, and then Ignite After School is effectively on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Dabney and members. I will try really hard to do this super quickly. So I'm here today on behalf of the PACER Center and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, as well as the Education Partnerships Coalition.
Can you introduce yourself, please, for the record?
Oh, I did. Sarah Clark, still here.
Good.
So quick. So PACER Center, it's a nationally renowned parent and family training and support center for our children with disabilities based here in Bloomington, Minnesota. And the PACER Center leads the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. Those coalition members include the Autism Society of Minnesota, Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, International Dyslexia Association, Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, the Prader-Willi Syndrome Association of Minnesota, and the ARC of Minnesota. You will have a copy of our policy agenda. Of course, it includes more support for special education. And I want to invite you all to join us for a tour of the Simon Assistive Technology Center at Pacers, so you can see some really great work they're doing there. And then on the Education Partnerships Coalition, this is a statewide network of collective impact organizations serving high-need children and families, their parents and children. Members of this coalition include the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, the Northside Achievement Zone, Northfield Promise, Every Hand Joined in Red Wing, Partners for Student Success in the St. Cloud area, Austin Aspires, and I think I got them all. So we look forward to working with you for our children with disabilities and for our children with high needs to improve outcomes. So thank you all for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Ignite After School is up next, and then Batting Cleanup is the Minnesota Library Association.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Dennison-Kanine, and I am with Ignite After School. Oh, you're up next.
You're doing great so far.
I'm with Ignite After School. We're Minnesota's statewide after school network, and we represent a number of organizations across the state that work with young people during after school. I'm really excited to be with you today to ask for your support in helping us to restore funding to the After School Community Learning Grants Bill. We have funded after school in the past, but haven't seen any funding since 2008. There's research that shows that when young people participate in high-quality after-school programs, they do better in school. And this is really critical, particularly to address the gap for low-income young people. High-income families and middle-income families spend about 7 times more on after-school enrichment opportunities for their children than low-income families. Often because low-income families can't quite make ends meet to be able to spend funding in for those kinds of opportunities. And we know from a federal, a very small pot of money that we have called the 21st Century Community Learning Center grants, which is federal funding, that when low-income young people participate for free and reduced price lunch youth, as well as English language learners, if they regularly participate in these programs, they do significantly better on their MCAs. So for ELL students, if they regularly participate, they're 125% more likely to be proficient on their math MCAs than those who don't regularly participate. So it has a huge impact. Yet in that federal program, there were 55 applications, and the Department of Ed was only able to fund 14 of them. So we have 41 communities and programs around the state that are ready to go, and just we don't have the funding. So we would really love to work with the committee to address the $12.1 million per year funding gap to make sure that we can fund these programs and address the educational disparities by investing in after school and addressing our world's best workforce goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dennison-Kanine. Ms. Hokanson.
Yes. Thanks for the invitation. My name is Ann Hokanson. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Library Association and a member of the Information and Technology Educators of Minnesota. I've learned a lot sitting here in the audience. Thanks, everyone, for saving me some time so that I can talk. Library issues aren't as complicated as many of the other things that you have here to think about, but they are very important and they're very relevant to education. I'm here to remind you face-to-face of the critical funding needs facing your regional library systems and of the importance of giving every Minnesota student access to well-trained, qualified media center and public library staff in schools and public libraries across the state. Minnesota consistently ranks in the top 10 or top 20 by many library performance indicators. Minnesota's libraries remain among the best in the nation. But we do have problems, and we do have a list of legislative priorities there in your handouts. Mary Murphy and Mary Kunesh Pudin are, of course, experts on many of these issues, and we thank you for all of the work all of you have done in the past on these problems for us. Minnesota's libraries are funded primarily with local dollars, but state funding plays the critical role of tying them all together into a cohesive, collaborative, efficient system that stretches from border to border. Some of your libraries are not able to do what we could and should do for Minnesotans, especially children, because of lack of state funding. We are at a point where failing to pass increases will force libraries to look at closing branches, restricting hours, among other cuts. You have in your handouts a speech given by Liz Lynch director of Lake Agassiz Regional Library System, on the negative effects on her system of the current funding level and distribution formula. I would point out that it's definitely a two-step problem, still not all that complicated to solve. We do have a solution we want you to put forward. Please consider this role libraries play in education for all Minnesotans, regardless of age, but for children in particular, and to take our funding needs into account as you move forward with your work. 11:14, pretty good.
Thank you very much. With that, we stand adjourned. See you next week.